All right, good to see everybody. My name is Matt Williams. I used to work here. Usually in the summer, I will take a few weeks and come off the stage. It doesn't affect some of the larger parts of my job that most people don't see, although you get to take some vacation. But for the most part, just coming off the stage, we keep teaching through the series of Proverbs as we've been doing. And it's been great for me to hear the other teachers and give some of our young guys at the different campuses opportunity to teach and kind of get their feet wet and all that. And also just lets me go not be on stage and be relieved of that kind of pressure. And so that's really feels healthy for me to do. I think some other people don't need it, but I do. So anyway, appreciate your graciousness through the summer and some of the feedback we're getting about the book of Proverbs. Been great. A couple weeks ago, let me catch up. I was with our student team on a mission trip in the Bahamas. And you go, oh my goodness, Bahama mission trip. I want to do that. Yeah, you think, right? Let me show you a couple pictures. This is Vacation Bible School. And one of the settlements, and this is us worshiping one night with the church that's right down the road, and those folks can sing better than we can. Right? I mean, they're blowing. It's like 110 degrees there. You can see Jeremy Kiever in the white shirt down here, the back of his neck, he is pouring in sweat. It was so hot. And so, and then I think we have one more maybe of some folks working. They don't look hot and tired. That must have been when we first started, because it got ugly, hot, and sweaty right there too. So right there, we're working on a special needs school that is all owned by the government, but the government doesn't take care of it. And so we go in, clear out, underbrush, paint the inside. We're building a climbing wall in the back for the kids. And so it's a combination of being able to share the gospel, engage folks on their level, in their place, in their home, in their settlement, being able to serve through hard work and through mercy ministry. And then at night, we are being taught. And so we're teaching the kids 1 Peter. So we're working the students, not kids, sorry, students, teaching them through the book of 1 Peter and making them interact with some of that material and breaking into groups. And so it's a powerful time. Just a great group. A lot of our students from Powdersville and Pelham Road working together. And we did get to sleep in the air conditioning. That was the only thing that was, otherwise I'd be dead. I wouldn't even be here. I would just like collapsed. Bring me home in a box. All right, so turn to Proverbs chapter 16. Proverbs chapter 16. I'll continue in the series. We're going to look at verses 18 and 19. That'll be a launching pad for us. It's page 384. I've got a handful of passages. I don't normally do that, but when we're doing something kind of topical, we got to kind of survey the whole Bible, and I'll feel bad if we don't. So I'll give you some page numbers. We can move quickly at the end. Some verses will be on the screen, but page 384, if you grab the Bible in the seat, which we just bought some new ones, so love for you to have that one, all right, if you don't have one. If you do have one, please stop stealing. If you don't have one and you take it, you're taking a gift from us. If you have a bunch at home, you're a thief. So don't keep taking them, right? I'm doing the same thing to my kids. I'm like, stop stealing them. They're like, you said we could. I was like, okay, I take it back. Proverbs 16. We're talking about the issue of humility and pride. C.S. Lewis said, the problem with humility is once you realize you got it, it's gone, right? Any self-awareness around the idea of humility just kind of ruins it for you. So it's difficult. Right? And a lot of what Christians consider to be humility may or may not be. And some of what we consider to be pride may or may not be. We probably have some stereotypes of nice. We probably make humility the same as external niceness. And bold strength, we probably confuse that with pride sometimes. So we probably have some work to do, of which we're only going to be able to scratch the surface. But there's a number of angles we can come at and a number of levels we can go to. We won't get to all that, but we'll get to some pieces and highlight a few things. The first angle I would take is that I think we'll start and we'll arrive at is the idea that my pride alienates me from a bunch of things, from my own soul, from other people, but ultimately from God. So when you were young, if you played sports and you go to the park and you pick up teams at the court or on the field and you're picking up, you know, and so if you're really good, you're thinking, Or if you're not good, you're thinking, hey, I want to be on that guy's team, or I want that guy to be on my team so we can be good, all right? Or that gal, whatever. And then, but if you're really good, you're thinking, I don't want that guy on my team. I want him on the other team because I want to show him how good I am, all right? Or I want to see, maybe in all humility, since he's the best, I'd like to see if I'm the best. So I don't want him to be on my team. I want to play against that person. But there's always, and I still play a little bit of basketball once or twice a week. It's really painful, but you know, take enough Advil, you can get through it. And so there's always, when I show up, there's always one or two guys that I'm always thinking, I sure hope I don't have to play against them. Because I know how it ends, okay? And we're all headed to the emergency room when we are, right? And so I'm always thinking, I hope I'm on John's team, I don't have to play against him, because he's mean, and he's hard, and he's strong, and he's physical. So I hope we're on the same team. And so here's what we're going to learn, is that the issue of pride so puts God on an opposite team from me. And really, it's not moving him, it's really moving me away from him. And puts me in an opposition to a very powerful opponent who can, even in his mercy, be very severe. And in his severity, be very merciful, but it's still severe. He's still an opponent. And an opponent who's way, 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 way more powerful than you are. And you find yourself in opposition to someone who now is working against you. Which, if he's God, would be a negative for any non-God character. All right? So Proverbs 16, verse 18. He says this, "Pride goes before destruction and haughtiness before a fall." Now, there's two ways to take it. You can take it in a real pragmatic way that my pride creates a blind spot in me that I can't see. And that inherent blind spot makes me vulnerable. So if I'm really, really smart, I can use this illustration since I'm not. If I'm really, really smart, I'm so confident in my abilities, tests come so easy that I don't study, and I wind up taking all that for granted for so long that I find myself in a situation where I really do need to study, but I don't because I have so much confidence. I go in and take a test and I wind up failing and blowing this huge opportunity because the pride creates a blind spot. Or I'm such a great athlete or so great at relating to people, you take something for granted, you ignore something, a relationship, you're a politician, you think since you helped make the law, that you're above the law, so you just disregard it, do whatever you want, and so it creates a blind spot of weakness that creates your fall. Is that a true statement? I think that is a true statement. Is that what this pastor is saying? I don't think so. So I'm interpreting things that aren't even here. Here's what I think from the greater context is. Not that that point's not true. I think the greater context is, it's passive. In this idea, is that pride goes before you getting destroyed or undone, torn apart is really the better word. And haughtiness before a fall that is brought on you. I think the idea, and I can't prove it from this one verse, you have to prove it from other verses. The idea is that God brings your fall, God brings your destruction, because he's so personally bothered by your arrogance. And so God is the one involved in your undoing. It's a personal offense to him. And I know you're going, how can that be? We'll get to it, hopefully. How much time we got? Yep. 19. Better to live humbly. This is a big statement. Better to live humbly with the poor than to share plunder with the proud. Here's the assumption. This is not always true, but this is the assumption that he's saying can be true in this setting. The assumption is that the proud person is also successful. You go, well, I know some proud people who aren't so. No, in this verse, right? This verse. That the proud person here is very successful, at least in the short run, and the humble person is the person who's poor and weak and who can't get it done. He goes, so assume that the person who's real arrogant and proud, he's a winner. She scores. She makes the great business deal. She's the best athlete. He's the best thinker. And so he's a winner, and he's won, and he's proud, and he went to battle, and he won the battle, and now he's gathered all the plunder to himself because he's that powerful, he's that smart, he's that great. And so the proud one is the successful winner, and the humble one is broken and poor. And now read it, verse 19. Better to live humbly with the poor than to share the plunder with the proud. He goes, better to be a loser and be with a bunch of losers in humility than to be with winners who are proud. And so what are we thinking? We're thinking, well, I want to be a rich winner who's humble. That's what I'll do. I'll choose that one. Because losing and poverty aren't really big goals for me. It's not really what I'm setting out to accomplish, right? And so I'm trying to think, how can I be the rich guy, the winner guy, and still be humble? He's going, it's another issue for another day. It's just hard. But here's the idea. is that pride goes before destruction, this arrogant spirit, this proud, before a huge fall. He goes, and if you had to choose, you don't always have to choose, if you had to choose, you'd rather be here than here. And most of us are going, no, I wouldn't, because I felt that. Because a lot of us have felt that. You've been around someone, everything's going their way, and you're thinking, how come everything's not going my way? And so whenever we first planted the church, there was this guy who was younger than I was, who we're interacting, and he's thinking about spiritual things and says he's a believer, probably not, and thinking about getting involved in church. And I see him working. I was like, oh, man. I was looking at his work truck. I was like, man, he's got an awesome truck. And so I was like, hey, where'd you get this truck? He said, I bought it from so-and-so. It's a great truck. And I was thinking, because I was moved here and I needed a truck. And, of course, I got to have a truck, so I'm wanting a truck too. I'm like, oh, I love that truck. And so, but it was old and beat up, which I love. That was great. And so then, like, 2 weeks later, I saw him, and he was in this new truck. I was like, hey, what happened to the truck? He goes, that's my work truck. I was like, what is this? He goes, this is my riding around truck. I was like, you're 22. You have a work truck and a riding around truck? So I go home to my wife. I was like, hey, I just graduated from seminary, and I'm trying to plant a church. I'm trying to do what God wants me to do, and this idiot has work truck and riding around truck. I got no truck. I was like, what am I doing wrong? I want truck. I don't have any truck. He's got two trucks. She goes, what are you saying? I was like, I don't know. And his life, and so the gratification is his life blows apart and he destroys himself and everybody else, and that made me feel better. And then I thought, why do I feel better about that? That's how jacked up I am. Okay? Better to live humbly with the poor than share plunder with the proud. None of us believe that. None of us want to embrace. I don't like that. I don't want to believe that. I'm reading a book about the history of Greenville right now. It's tedious, it's long, and it's fascinating. And a lot of the guys who came in and settled Greenville, a lot of the names you drive on their streets right now, a lot of the surrounding cities are named after them. They came in here in the late 1700s, and they basically lied and stole and gathered a bunch of land for themselves, and they were not honest about what they did. They cheated the British government and the emerging American government and the Indians. They cheated everybody. They had thousands and thousands of acres, and we name roads, and we like, oh, look at this road right here. Look after them. That's great. And so on the short run, it looks like even over the whole of their life, they kind of won, that they were rewarded for their arrogance, for their pride, for their ability to make things happen. But there's more to it than that. There's this temporal piece, but there's this eternal piece also. Look at James 4:13. We're going to get indicted a little further. It's page 736. New Testament, James chapter 4, verse 13, half-brother of Jesus. I got this in Luke 14. I'm going to read, and then we'll look at 1 Peter real quick. So James 4:13, I was the winner of 1 year early in the 90s. I was 23 years old, and we were doing a series at Denton Bible Church on the book of James, and Tom Nelson taught this passage. And isn't it weird how, like, some things you hear and it just stays with you forever? There's other parts of this book, I have no idea what he said, but it's just wherever you are and God's speaking to you, it just locks in, and this penetrated me and never ever left me. 4:13, he says, come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that town and spend a year there and do business and make a profit. He said, now listen to me. You do not know about tomorrow, what your life is like or what it will be like, for you are a puff of smoke that appears for a short time and then vanishes. You ought to say instead, if the Lord is willing, then we will live and do this or we will do that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. He says, it's interesting, and their culture would not have been near as transient as ours. He said, you're saying, tomorrow we'll go here, and next week we'll go there, and next month we'll go there, and next year we'll go there, and then we're going to set up a business, and we're going to sell, and we're going to buy, and we're going to import, we're going to export, we're going to make some money, and it's going to be all great, and we'll come back here, and we'll build a new house. It'll be all great. And notice what he says in 16. He goes, this is a mark of your arrogance. He goes, your life, he goes, these things you think you have control over. Your transportation, he goes, this other city, he goes, you have no control over the fact that a war could break out in that city. You have no control over the air that you're breathing. Mount Vesuvius blows up, there will be no air for you to breathe. You will be burned right where you stand. He goes, you have no control over your heartbeat. Are you making your heartbeat this next moment or not? And so he just indicts us around our pride and our presumption that I'll go to Charleston next week, I'll drive my car there. I won't get in a wreck. I'll keep breathing. My heart will keep beating. I don't need God for this. He goes, all of that kind of presumptive thinking is evil because it unseats God from the throne as sovereign of the universe and exalts myself into a place of sovereignty that says, I will or I won't. I will handle it without acknowledgement, without thinking. And so we were in the Bahamas on this mission trip. Someone gets hurt, really hurt. What are we going to do? We're going to stop and pray because there are no medical facilities on the island. And to get air-vacked somewhere, get an evac somewhere, is going to cost money that nobody has. So a few weeks before this, we're in my hometown, and we've been eating dinner at this restaurant, and out back there's this pond with alligators, and so my kids go out there and look at the alligators, whatever. And my youngest leans against the fence, five-year-old, and who knows how this happened, but a piece of wire hanging from the fence, she leans into it and it catches in her eye, right underneath her eyeball. It pokes into her eye, right underneath her eyeball, and it freaks her out, you might imagine. She jerks and it just slits right in her eye, not underneath her eye, inside, in the quick, right? When I come outside, I'm like, oh, so good, great meal. I'm like, somebody's kid is crying. Somebody needs to get control of their children. I look over, Laurel's going, hello, it's ours. When I look around the car, her face is covered in blood, her hands are covered in blood, which is what you want to see from a five-year-old. I come over, what's wrong? I can't see. Not good. Nothing about this 10 minutes is going well. I throw her in the car, I grew up there, I'm headed straight to the hospital. Okay, I'm not saying on some level I'm not praying, God, let this be okay, but that ain't what I'm doing. I'm going to the hospital. Why? Because I got one. So I'm actually functioning independently of God. She's fine. All right, she's good. Doctor said, never seen anything like it. How she didn't puncture her eyeball, have no idea. It's a miracle, which he didn't really believe in miracles, but we couldn't really get that worked out for him. Anyway, I'm going, emergency room didn't work out. Took it to urgent care center. We got it all worked out because I have that resource. And so if I don't have that resource, my dependence on God goes way up. When I do have that resource, my dependence on God goes way down. I naturally become arrogant in the affluence that I have in the affluence of my culture. It breeds arrogance that I don't even understand. Right? I mean, I'm arrogant and don't even know it in that moment. Luke 14, page 627, Luke 14, Jesus' words. When Jesus noticed... Luke 14, page 627. When Jesus noticed that all who had come to dinner, it's a banquet, were trying to sit in the seats of honor near the head of the table, he gave them this advice. I mean, in a party, he interrupts the party to talk. Verse 8. When you're invited to a wedding feast, don't sit in the seat of honor. What if someone who is more distinguished than you has also been invited? Oh no, that's a good question. The host will come and say, hey, give this person your seat. Then you will be, what? Embarrassed. And you will have to take whatever seat is left at the foot of the table. Instead, take the lowest place at the foot of the table. Then when your host sees you, he will come and say, friend, we have a better place for you. Then you will be honored in front of all guests. It is the pragmatism that we've come to expect from Jesus. Because I've always wondered, how should I handle myself at a party? How should I handle myself at a feast? Jesus, if I were going to a wedding, what should I do? It's the pragmatism that we want from a Messiah who says, hey, if you ever find yourself in a social setting, make sure that you kind of hang back, position yourself in a humble place so that when something opens up at the front, they'll exalt you to the front. If you go exalt yourself, you're going to get humbled, and that's going to be embarrassing. You're not going to look good. And you just look at that and go, man, thank you so much for giving me some application right there. And so, you know, it can be a difficult situation. I always want to know, what am I supposed to do when I get to the social setting? And what do I do about order, rank, status, all that? And you're left going, thanks, some great advice, thank you. Until you read verse 11. And then he says this, for those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. And there's an ominous moment as this language hangs in the air, and you go, oh my goodness, he's not talking about wedding feast. This wedding feast, this moment, was an illustration for something much bigger that relates to all of life. And so Jesus says, I mean, I'd love to talk about wedding feasts. It's always important to know how to handle yourself in a social setting, except that Jesus goes, that's not what I'm talking about. Wedding feasts are just one small thing in life. Jesus says, I'm talking about all of life and everything about life after this. Is that it is more than about banquets. He's saying, you need to position yourself for humility. The ones who humble themselves in this life will be exalted in life eternal. And then within this life, those who humble themselves here will be exalted here in some way, some fashion. Those who exalt themselves, and here's what you have to get. We'll talk about why and how in just a moment, but listen to this. For verse 11, for those who, this is really, really important, for those who exalt themselves, it's what they do to themselves, they will be humbled by somebody else, presumably God. And then those who humble themselves, they will be exalted, third person, by somebody else, presumably God. So, we're in an inverse relationship with what God is doing. Whatever we do, He's doing the opposite. So if we're exalting, He's in charge of humbling. If we're humbling, He's in charge of exalting. He goes, you just understand, you're working in this seesaw kind of deal with God that's really, really important, and you don't want to mess it up. And so when someone says, man, I just pray that God humbles me, there's, no, you don't. That's not really, it's not that He can't, and it's not that He won't. He's humbled bunches of people. But here's what He's saying from Proverbs all the way through. He's going to say, you do it to yourself. You might want to be in charge of this part of your life, of humbling yourself, so that He'll do the exalting part rather than forcing Him to humble you after you've exalted yourself. So prideful people are not rare. They're really common, and our room's full of them. And so it's not like this sermon is meant for 10% of us or 40% of us or 80% of us. Everybody in the room is prideful. The difference is that for half of us, it's really easy to see. And for the other half, it's not so easy to see. So some of you are really, really good at covering up how you think and how you feel. And anything that would come off as socially awkward or arrogant or proud, you have a gift at reading the moment and saying, oh, I'm not going to say, I'm feeling this, but I'm not going to say it, because then they'll all know. And you take great pleasure in watching other people make idiots out of themselves. That's why you enjoy me so much. And so if you watch my wife can go into just about any social setting, and she knows exactly how to act. She knows, like someone says something, I'm always like, I don't know what to say. And I'm like waiting, and then she says something. I'm like, yes, that was brilliant. How did you know how to say that? Like, I just don't know how that works. So she knows how to handle herself. I, on the other hand, so you'd never really know if she was prideful or not. And some of you think, oh, gosh, she's so sweet. Maybe. But you wouldn't know. You wouldn't know because she could handle you. Like, I can't handle you. You see my deal, right? So you know what's going on in his head. You're like, he's a little crazy, right? But at least you kind of see that. So some of us can cover it up. Some others can't cover it up as well. But let me just give some categories for you. So just know, think, oh, there's some prideful people. No, we're all prideful. Successful people can be very prideful because they naturally become independent. My story of having health care. I'm looking for my health care card and not having to really pray because I need a doctor. Older people can be prideful because they've experienced so much, they know everything. People who want control, who worry all the time. It's part of pride. Because I need to control it because God can't control it, so I'm going to have to control it. Or I worry all the time about what's going to happen because what I'm saying is, because I'm a worrier, it means that I need control, that God's not in control, or I can't trust Him to control it, so I'm going to worry. Lazy people are proud because they think they deserve to have something, but they don't want to work for it. They just expect it to kind of come to them. People who always get their feelings hurt, they're proud. Because they're kind of at the center of the universe, and you should speak in a way that never hurts my feelings. I can't believe you're always hurting my feelings. And so they kind of move themselves to the center. People who dislike authority have a problem with pride because they think no one should be able to tell them what to do. People who are impatient. It was hard for me to write this one down. People who are impatient feel like they deserve for things to move at a pace that orients around them. People who are young, they can be prideful because they think they're bulletproof. They don't have a large enough context to realize that everything doesn't work the way they think it works. They think they're going to live forever and they can do whatever they want. Folks who have a sense of entitlement, they've made themselves the center. Those of us who presume about this, about that, how it should be, how I want it to be, how it ought to be. Folks who are insecure. When you meet someone who's insecure, the last thing you think is, look how prideful this person is. But the insecure person has exalted themselves to such a place of self-protection. They're just that important. They have to be protected all the time. So they never really want you to know. They never really will put themselves out there. They're constantly in hiding, protecting themselves because that's how important they are. People who think, and this is bad in religious cultures, our church struggles with it. People who think they're better than other people, they're constantly evaluating and judging. Those who are bitter is an act of pride because I've set myself up as a judge and I'm holding somebody accountable for something till I get paid and it's made me bitter that I have not been paid yet for what you did to me. It's an act of pride. It's a thought of pride. It's a heart of pride. People who are not generous, they've made themselves owners of their possessions. They won't part with their money, with their things, with their time. They're not generous because they own. They're the center. Folks of us who struggle with image, how I look, how my kids make me look, how my spouse makes me look, my status in the culture, all of that is about pride. So did I get most of us? Right? I mean, I was just really working from my own personal inventory, but I figured it would include a lot of you too. 1 Peter chapter 5, page 740. Last verse we'll look at that I'll have you look up. 1 Peter 5, page 740. In the same way, and you can go back and read the context about what the other way was, but in the same way, you younger men must accept the authority of the elders. And all of you serve each other in humility. And then he quotes, probably from Proverbs 3, combined with some other Old Testament ideas. For God opposes the proud, but he favors the humble. So now we have it in full circle. Is that now we have it in explicit writing. Is it the proud one? God kind of mounts up and goes, oh, yeah, I'll take that. I see which team you're on. I choose to be on the opposite team. That my pride engages him in a way that's not going to be good, in a non-harmonious way. I engage him as an opponent when I'm prideful. For God opposes the proud, but he gives favor to the humble. So now we're in opposition to God because our status is rising as a false king. My status, I'm elevating my status as an illegitimate ruler and an illegitimate king in my pride. Even if it's only in my mind, he opposes me as a false king. And some of us will say, how can God be so insecure that our pride bothers him? Listen, it is wrong when a child dismisses or disrespects their parent that has served and sacrificed and given their life for them. There's something broken and wrong about that. That is true in the micro. My relationship with God is the macro of that. The distance between my youngest child and me and my authority and responsibility and care for her is like this much distance between us compared to this much distance between who God is and who I am. Like I have much more in common and am much more closely related to my youngest child than I will ever be to God and what he has done for me and how gracious and kind he's been. And it's a serious problem. Isaiah 14, you don't have to turn here. We have a slide for this. Isaiah 14 talks about Satan. For you said to yourself, and it's talking about a king of the day as well as Satan, I will ascend to heaven and set my throne above God's stars. I will preside on the mountain of the gods far away in the north. I will climb to the highest heavens, and look at this, I will be like the Most High. This is Satan's inherent problem, is that he is so beautiful, he is so powerful, and he says, I'm tired of being second. I'm ready to exalt myself. That is the core of pride. It's a self-exaltation. And then we get this, speaking about elders in 1 Timothy 3, that when we go to ordain new elders, they said, here's something to be careful. An elder must not be a new believer, not because it's a bad thing, but because he might become proud and the devil will cause him to stumble. And so he finds himself in the wheelhouse of the devil. He finds himself in an environment and in an attitude that Satan can handle very easily. So verse 6, he says it again, of 1 Peter 5. So humble who? Yourselves. So who does it? I do. You do. Not someone else. Don't even have to pray about it. So humble yourself under the mighty power of God, and at the right time, he will lift you up in honor. And for some of us, we're casting out some false humility, going, I mean, what does it mean to be lifted up in honor? Who knows? Who cares? What difference does it make? I ain't in charge of that part. What's so funny is I'm worried about God exalting me in honor. I'm not in charge of that. All I need to do is stop exalting myself now. That's the thing I need to be focused on. It's not worrying about what is it like for me to be exalted later and be like, oh, that could be prideful, that could be weird. No, I need to stop exalting myself now. Humble myself now and start figuring out what does it look like for me personally to humble myself. Jesus said, go and sit. Go to the back. Go sit in the back. You assume responsibility and position yourself. And you go, are we talking about behavior? We're talking about heart. Yes, we're talking about both. The heart does drive behavior. We need to deal with the heart. But there are some issues of the heart that you can't deal with directly. You don't have real access to it because it's too close to you. It's too much a part of who you are to really discern what's going on in my own heart. So it's just like heart drives behavior, behavior has an effect on heart. So there's some actions that I can do that expose my heart. So there's some things where I serve. There's some places where I serve that are not connected to our church. And sometimes I get myself in this situation and I'm thinking, cannot believe I signed up for this. What am I doing? And I would never say this, except now. There's a part of me going, I'm way too important to be doing this. Do these people not know what I do? I got to be studying God's word. I got stuff to do. I can't believe I let myself get in this situation. I got stuff to do. I should be doing something else. And I hear my heart say that, and I'm like, oh, that's not good. And so part of that action, that behavior helps expose what's going on here, what I'm secretly starting to believe, what I'm secretly starting to own. Some of the nastiness that's deep inside of me is getting exposed in that moment. I'm like, oh, I need to make peace with this. And the great thing is, you can. For the believer, he can make peace with it. So let me give you some things, some ideas, some applicational ideas, some things to do. All right? First one is this. So what do I do? Here's what you can do. Is that with your friends and your family, your spouse, parents, friends, the whole deal, right? You need to be in conversations about your pride. That needs to be a normal conversational topic. Right? Where you acknowledge the possibility of your pride. Where when you say, if I sit in an elders meeting and say, I hear something that bothers me about what's going on right there, now I recognize that some of my pride is probably involved in this. This probably bothers me because of my own pride. Then I need to be able to just acknowledge that and put that out there. And then one of the elders can go, you know, you're right. I was like, I thought I was right. No, you're right about the first part, your pride. That is your pride. That needs to be normal discussion without people getting their feelings hurt. Your spouse needs to look at you and go, I hear you. Some of what you're saying is legitimate. That's legit. That's a fair point. That's good. Yep, your boss did do that. But here's the thing. A lot of this is really wrapped around your pride. And then with you freaking out, I can't believe you call me prideful. Can't believe you say that. You're not supporting me. You're not encouraging. I'm coming to you for encouragement. Right, we can encourage all day long down this road, but it's not going to end well, right? So we need to be able to acknowledge our pride. We need to be able to speak. And for me, it's always been such a big deal that I could never look at a nice person and go, oh, that's your pride. Because I was like, how would I say that to them? Look at me. But here's the deal. Pride isn't about personality. Personalities help cover up or expose it, but they don't decide whether we have it or not. We got it. We all have it, right? And so we just kind of have to recognize that's part of our deal. It needs to be a normal part of our conversation. For parents, your children cannot expose their pride on their own. They can't humble themselves on their own. So you have to do that. You got to own that piece. From 18 months, 9 months old, 18 months old, all the way. 7 years old, 9 years old, 12 years old, it looks different. 15 years old, 18 years old. You've got to play a role in helping expose their pride. You've got to be honest with them, and you've got to show them. And so one of the greatest ways to do it is teach, picking up on what Bill said, whenever that was, a couple weeks ago, cannot keep your young hearts in your home from working. Working is one of the great humblers. Right, so that the young man in your home, he has to go out and work, not just be great at video games. He needs to go work at something that is hot and tiring, where he has to endure, and he doesn't win. It doesn't really go well, and he has to endure that. That humbles his heart in a way that the Bible can speak to. When he never has to meet the grind, his heart becomes so proud and lifted up, you can't tell him anything. And here's the thing, be careful when you tell, and our girls dress up, princess, all that, be careful how you tell your girls that they're a princess. Some of the men in our congregation, you're telling your daughter she's a princess and sparing her from work. Tell her she's a princess, but she needs to work and work hard. Proverbs 31, that woman works hard. She knows how to do a lot of things. She knows how to get gas for herself and get her hands dirty. That is not, her being clean and not being able to work and being lazy is putting a burden on a future husband and is not making her a princess. She's a princess because she's created the image of God and Jesus died for her, right? Not because you made her lazy and arrogant, right? So that is a role of parents to be involved in that. Next idea is you need to be involved in what we would call a community group. A community group that is not perfect with imperfect people that is not going to meet your expectations. But in that context, in that setting, our hearts get humbled. We learn how to give ourselves to other people, and they give themselves to us. We learn how to serve. Some of us feel like, all right, I'm putting myself in that category. You get into some situation, you're thinking, I can't believe I'm doing this. That shows a broken heart. There's mundanity that needs to be brought to us. We need to be involved in things that are powerfully mundane, that take up time and energy, that may or may not be that fulfilling. Learn how to serve other people. Serve in situations that are challenging and difficult, that aren't in our comfort zone all the time. If you lead a community group for our church, if you lead a small group of students, or you lead a classroom of children, please know that part of your role is to help expose the pride of those that you lead. You go, what about my pride? Yours too. Got to expose yours too. This is a spiritual killer for us. And here's the motivation. Here's what's really, really important that kind of sinks into us. Philippians 2, 8 and 9. We probably have a slide for this too. Talking about Jesus, he humbled himself in obedience to God. He died a criminal's death on a cross. Therefore, God elevated him to the place of highest honor and gave him the name above all his names. But look back. Humbled himself. He said he humbles himself, comes under, gives his life away, and ultimately there's exaltation in it. But he humbles himself and takes on a burden that's not even his. See, my pride will keep me from saying I'm sorry or apologizing or owning a mistake that is mine. But Jesus is so humble, not only can he own his own deal, is that he owns somebody else's. I'm so prideful, not only am I not going to own anybody else's, I'm not even going to own mine. I mean, we have men in our congregation who've never apologized to anybody in their family. We have moms who've never apologized to their kids, never did anything wrong. We have women who will not come to their husband and go, you were right and I'm wrong, I blew it, I'm being too demanding, too many expectations. We're struggling to own our own deal, and Jesus is saying, the writer is saying, the Spirit is saying through the writer, through Paul, that Jesus is so humble, he leaves heaven, comes to earth, dies a death, not just any death, death on a cross, falsely accused as a criminal, so that he can own something that's not even his. That's how humble he is. Is that a great pride? Is that a great example of how we deal with pride and humility? It is a great example. Is it a great model? It is a great model. Is it only a model? It is not only a model. More importantly than a great model, it is a moment of exchange where he dies for me and gives me righteousness. And I take my sin, God takes my sin and puts it on him. And so the identity that I'm trying through my pride to scrape together, to build, to show off, I come to a moment of humility myself and recognize I don't really have that much to scrape together. I mean, even what I put together isn't really that impressive in the big picture. So it makes it easier to release and go, you know what? My identity that I was working so hard to pull together really wasn't that great. And so I'm gonna let that go. And I'm going to exchange my identity for his, and I'm going to take on his identity. So when someone says, there's no way I can apologize to her again. There's no way I can forgive her again. There's no way I can do that. Well, the reason you can't, you're right. Because if it's your identity and it's your life on the line, and it's your deal, your ego that you're having to maintain, you're right. You're not going to be able to let that go. But if you've exchanged your identity for Jesus, then you're free of your own ego. You're free of your own status. You're free of your own empire that you were trying to build, or your own wall that you were trying to protect to secure yourself and make yourself safe and stable. And so the one who's free is free to say that they're sorry. They're free to be wrong. They're free to suffer injustice and move on without bitterness. They're free to be misunderstood. They're free to stop striving to draw attention to themselves. The cross of Jesus is actually not just a display of his humility. It's actually an opportunity and a doorway into ours. that goes beyond just my own personal efforts and energy. And so for a lot of believers in the room, it's kind of a reminder, I got to deal with my pride. But here's what I would say. We have more and more non-Christians in our church, thinking big thoughts, wondering, dreaming, asking questions. And there are a number of you in this room who you have never trusted in Christ, and so you are not free of your own ego. You're actually enslaved. Romans 16, Jude, he would say, you're enslaved to your own desires. These things that well up inside of you, some of which are good, some of which are not so good. You're actually a slave to your own ego and your own pride. And it's actually a tremendous weight that you carry. It's a burden that you carry that you have to maintain and protect all the time and make sure you get justice for and make sure you get treated correctly. It's actually a tremendous burden on you. I would invite you, if you have never trusted in the death and resurrection of Jesus as a sacrifice that would pay for your sins and given your life to Him and said, I trust you to pay for my sins. I'm asking you to give me life. I would encourage you to do that. And so if you have questions about that, we'll be here after the service. We'd love to help, love to talk, love to help you start that journey and begin to think about what that could mean, what it could look like. Let's pray. Father, as we sing, we want to give ourselves to you again. We want to humble ourselves in a way that says, no matter who's looking or not, or what people think or don't, we want to enter into a time that just honors you, that gives us a few moments in a hectic life to be able to listen to your voice and incorporate it, think about it deeply, and begin to apply it. And so for some of us, we're having to acknowledge there's some things we believe that aren't good, and we need to reject those beliefs. And for some of us, there's some things that we have not been willing to acknowledge that now we got to think about and we need to acknowledge. And then for some of us, there are things that we need to do that we have not yet done. And so there are some actions that we need to take that might expose what's going on in our heart and our soul. So Father, would you lead us? You lead us as a group. As we move towards you, you speak to us as a group, but you also speak to us as individuals. So give us the ability to see and to hear and to understand that these words would not come to us in vain, that they would not be ignored or disregarded, that we'd be able to see, hear, and we'd be able to act on them and honor you in how we respond. It's in your name we pray. Amen.